Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my coat.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Denise Katz-Prober, Director of Legal Initiatives for the Brandeis Center, discussing its efforts to legally counteract anti-Semitism on campus. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. We're in the last days of the period of the counting of the Omer, the Sfirat HaOmer in Jewish tradition, the 7 weeks between the holidays of Passover and Shavuot, between Pesach, the great festival of freedom, and Shavuos, the celebration of covenant with God. This week, Tuesday night and Wednesday, we will celebrate the Feast of Weeks. Shavuot is among the least appreciated and observed of the major Jewish festivals, which is somewhat ironic for several reasons. In biblical times, Shavuot was one of the three pilgrimage festivals during which we Jews living in Israel literally walked to Jerusalem to celebrate the holiday. Along with Passover in the spring and Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths in the fall, Shavuot, sometimes called Pentecost for the 50 days between Pesach and Shavuot, Shavuot in the early summer was a central ritual observed by our ancestors as they gathered to bring offerings to God from their earliest harvests of the agricultural year. And in some ways, what we were celebrating at Shavuot was more important than the historical events that the other festivals commemorated. Shavuot was based not just on the first ingathering of fruits and grains, but on the receiving of the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, greatest revelation of God given to our people and perhaps any people ever. In Jewish tradition, this experience at Mount Sinai, connecting with the divine in a way we'd never done so before, and doing so as an entire people, is the central moment of our nation's history. It was at that point when God connected with the people of Israel that we truly became Israel. According to later tradition, not only were the Ten Commandments given aloud to the entire nation of Israelites, but the whole Torah was given as well on Mount Sinai. Later tradition amplified this to include the whole Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, the written Torah, and even the Talmud, the oral Torah, all given to Moses at Sinai. That is, all Jewish learning, ethics, and mitzvot, the commanded acts of righteousness, were given to our people at Mount Sinai on this great holiday of Shavuot. It is the events of this festival of Shavuos, the receiving of commandment at Mount Sinai, that form the basis of Judaism, today as in antiquity. The understanding that one God is the source of all morality, that ethics and ritual exist to bring us to goodness and holiness, that being a Jew is a moral calling with responsibilities to all other people in the nation of Israel and all human beings, these come from the events that led to this festival of Shavuot. The ritual traditions of Shavuos are related to the experience at Mount Sinai. In addition to a short evening service, a festival service, committed Jews study all night, seeking inspiration in the classic texts of our tradition, together, exploring Torah, Talmud, Kabbalah, Musar, Midrash. And since, according to tradition as well, even the animals heard the voice of God at Mount Sinai so long ago, we don't eat meat on Shavuot. That's led to the custom of eating cheesecake and other dairy delicacies, along with the coffee that keeps us awake for this all-night study. If you live in Jerusalem, as I did one Shavuot long ago, at dawn, you join a procession of other pilgrims going to the Western Wall to pray the morning services, Shacharit. It's a very cool experience indeed, and a wonderful festival, which makes the contemporary indifference to Shavuos somewhat mystifying. There are reasons for this, of course, as there are reasons for every form of human conduct. Shavuot comes during the late days of spring or early summer, when people's attention has shifted to vacations and travel and summer plans. And in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, it has gotten so hot, it seems like a good idea to travel anywhere else. And unlike Passover and Sukkot, the other two pilgrimage festivals, Shavuot is a brief holiday. It's just one day of celebration in Israel, and for Reform Jews, just 2 days at most. For Orthodox or Conservative Jews, that means it's kind of over not long after it starts, unlike the more extended holidays of Pesach and Sukkot. And some of us don't like staying up all night as much as we once did, of course. Still, Shavuot is a wonderful and meaningful holiday, and one that should be observed. This year, here in Tucson, we're holding a community Shavuot commemoration at the Jewish Community Center. It's called Meeting at the Mountain. It begins at 7 p.m. and ends with dawn at 4 a.m. It's free. There's food and coffee. I, Rabbi Sam Kohan, am teaching part of it at 8 o'clock. I don't know that I'll make it all the way to 4 a.m. myself, but I do recommend observing this important holiday with both cheesecake and, more importantly, Jewish study, filled with meaning and value and inspiration. To play us in this morning, here's a Shavuot song from Israel, where, among the founders of the nation, the holiday became a celebration for the renewal of the land and its produce, a place flowing with milk and honey, as the Bible says. It's called Bikurei Shavuot, first fruits of the Festival of Shavuos, coming up Tuesday night and Wednesday. Lechad Shavuot Naaseh Lecha Bikurei Ktzichitim Bikurei Ktzichitim Bikurei Ktzichitim Hazorim Bedima Hazorim Bedima Berina That was Chag Shavuot, the song, the holiday of Shavuot, coming up this week. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Denise Katz-Prober, Director of Legal Initiatives for the Brandeis Center, tells us what that important institution is doing to counteract the dramatic increase in anti-Semitism on college campuses ever since October 7th. Find out when we return in just a moment right here on To Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Denise Katz-Prober is Director of Legal Initiatives for the Brandeis Center, which works against the anti-Semitic activity we've seen on campuses, obviously, all over the United States over the last several months. But Brandeis Center has been working on this for quite a while. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this is a tough time, isn't it? Tell us a little bit about, first of all, the Brandeis Center's work in general. We've spoken to Ken Marcus before, but give us a little bit of a background on what you guys do.
So the Brandeis Center was established over a dozen years ago by Kenneth Marcus. He is the former head of the Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Education. The Brandeis Center's mission is to advance the civil and human rights of the Jewish people and promote justice for all. Historically, The bulk of our work has focused on using legal tools to combat antisemitism on college and university campuses. In more recent years, we've also expanded to use similar tools to combat antisemitism in K-12 schools, workplace, and other areas of society.
So this has been, I think, a shocking period ever since October 7th. Obviously, there have been anti-Semitic incidents and anti-Zionist aspects of campus life for quite a while. This has intensified tremendously. How does that affect your work?
All of that is correct. So at the Brandeis Center, our reaction to October 7th was similar to many, where we were absolutely horrified by the just eruption and the explosion of anti-Semitism on college and university campuses, as well as the virulence and prevalence. But at the Brandeis Center, we were not shocked. Because for years, we've been concerned and fighting back against the same forms of anti-Semitic hatred involving harassment and discrimination of students on campuses. What we've noticed over the years and warned administrators and those who are concerned about what's going on campus is that very often university administrators are not properly diagnosing the problem that is before them. They think that when a Jewish student comes to them and complains of being targeted based on Zionism, that what they're witnessing is a political debate, a difference of political opinion, and therefore the university administrators throw up their hands and say, I don't want to get involved. I don't want to be seen as taking a side in the political debate. I don't want to press anyone's free speech. And they step away and don't do anything. So what we've been seeing even before October 7th is that when Jewish students express aspects of their Jewish identity connected to Israel and Zionism, for that, they are being mistreated. They are being excluded from clubs on campus, made to feel unwelcome in certain spaces on campus. They are being shunned and isolated, in some cases harassed relentlessly. And this is the form of anti-Semitism that is most prevalent, but on college university campuses even before October 7th, but unfortunately least understood and most difficult for university administrators to recognize. So what we've seen after October 7th is that this same form or manifestation of anti-Semitism is continuing on college and university campuses with renewed or increased virulence. But we're also seeing the nature of attacks on Jews become more aggressive and bold. We're seeing a record number of physical assaults and harassment, and this is quite alarming. Although it is not completely a new phenomenon, there is no doubt that since October 7th, things have gotten increasingly worse for Jewish students on most college and university campuses.
We will come back and speak much more with Denise Katz-Prober, Director of Legal Initiatives at the Brandeis Center, particularly addressing the encampment movement and some of the anti-Semitic issues that have arisen there when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established nearly 6 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community striving every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is available now for school-age children or grandchildren. Celebrating our sixth year in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come in person Friday night, 6:30 p.m., Shabbat celebration services, followed by a delicious own Oneg Shabbat, always, or Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. Shabbat morning services, always followed by a Kiddush, including our Torah reading and services, of course, all with me, Rabbi Sam Cohen, leading them. Services are available on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are available live in person and on Zoom. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah text programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, everything from Torah to mysticism, taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Cohen, in the most dynamic and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you're recently back from a trip to the southern boot of Italy, the area of Puglia, which has a great Jewish history that I didn't know anything about, and I think you didn't either before you went.
I knew about vague rumors, but I knew no details. And I made two surprise discoveries, one of which has to be explored further on another trip. But the town where we started is called Lecce, which is called the Florence of the South. It's an absolutely beautiful city. It resembles Jerusalem in the sense that all the buildings are built of the same stone. It's a honey-colored stone. Mm. So the whole city has this lovely, like, honey color. It's very harmonious, and it's very old. I mean, it was a Greek city, then it was a Roman city, then it was a Byzantine city, then it was a Muslim city, then it was a Norman city, then it belonged to the Ottomans. I mean, all these people have come and gone.
Yeah,
and
kind of like Sicily that way, maybe even more so.
Yeah, they all left physical traces of their presence. And sometimes in one building, there's like six different cultural styles from different times in the history of the region. But anyway, so Lecce is built like most Italian cities, around a so-called centro storico, the historic center. And the streets are not pedestrian only, but they might as well be. They're so narrow that nobody can drive quickly or drive in a big car on these streets. So it's basically a walking city. And to my great surprise, it was thronged with tourists already in the first weeks of May.
Wow.
Like long before you would imagine that the season begins. And my buddy from Milano, who was showing me around, said, trust me, it's much worse in June and July. It's just packed. Anyway, we're walking around and he shows me, he's got a friend who's a big hotelier, a hotel owner in the region. He owns like all the luxury hotels in the whole region. And he's originally a Persian Jew. And this guy donated a lot of money to the municipality of Lecce to restore a synagogue right in the heart of town, which now actually serves as a Jewish museum, which is fascinating. And the Jewish community there goes back to at least the Roman times. And, you know, it had its ups and downs because for much of its history, all of southern Italy was part of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, and it was run by Spanish kings. So you hear the Italian version of their names, like Carlo Quinto is Charles
V. Charles
V,
yeah.
Carlo Quattro is Charles IV. Anyway, these guys took part in the Inquisition, and Jews were expelled frequently. So today in Lecce, there's no Jews left, but there is this museum. And the one place where they've resuscitated a Jewish community that's very ancient is called Trani, T-R-A-N-I. It's in the northern reaches of Puglia. We didn't get anywhere near Trani. But having read more about Trani after the fact, I'm determined to make a trip there. In fact, maybe lead a trip there. And the reason that I got interested in it was I had vaguely heard in the past that Trani once had a lot of synagogues and a major Jewish community. Then when I first started posting on Facebook photos of my trip, a childhood friend who made Aliyah like 50 years ago and has lived in Israel ever since, and he works as a tour guide, so he's kind of in the biz. He said, are you going to Trani? I have a niece from there. Why does he have a niece from there? Because one of his sons married an Israeli woman whose family comes from Trani.
Huh.
And Joey, my friend, knew all about the history of Trani, which was that at points in its history, it was like 40% Jewish. The Jews ran the port and all the trading businesses.
40%?
A port on the Adriatic. There were four major synagogues there, not to mention minor little prayer houses.
Shtiebels, but they wouldn't have called them that.
Right. And the community was largely destroyed during the Shoah, but there were few left, and there were all these beautiful old synagogues left. So the Jewish community of Naples, which is larger and very well organized, sort of adopted Trani as their orphan brother. Huh. It's about 2 hours away by expressway, by highway.
Just go the other side of the peninsula.
Go due east, right. So they got the Italian government and the European Union to spend a lot of money to renovate the shuls. And one of the shuls now functions because there's a community of about 200 people there where there were none like 50 years ago.
Wow.
You know, in Italy, the Jewish quarter is called La Giudecca. And the Giudecca of Trani is very central and very large. So you can see like what percentage of the old city was Jewish.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I've got to go. Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe is visiting a zoo in Tel Aviv when he notices that one of the cages just has loaves of challah scattered all over the floor. Moshe calls over a zookeeper and asks, why is there all that challah in the cage? Well, the zookeeper explains, it's bred in captivity. You see, challah is bred and it's locked in a cage. Forget it. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you, you should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the second portion of the book of Numbers, Naso, which includes a remarkable blessing. The Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing, which has become popular not only among Jews, but among Christians as well, is really three distinct brachot, three separate prayers, with which the ancient priests, the Kohanim, were commanded to bless the people. From its inception, this three-part blessing has had exceptional importance. The Torah quotes God as saying, "With this blessing you place my name on the people of Israel, Samu et Shemi al Bnei Yisrael." That is, this very blessing will convey God's presence among us and offer divine protection. The blessing was given by the Kohanim, highest class of priests, those entrusted with the service of the tabernacle and later the temple. We still use this blessing in every joyous life cycle event, and it remains powerful. It is used as well on the pilgrimage festivals like Shavuot this week. The text of the Birkat Kohanim is, "May God bless you and guard you. May the light of God's presence shine on you and be gracious to you. May God's presence turn to you and give you peace. Shalom." In essence, the Birkat Kohanim asks God to supply our most important needs. Most interpretations of this Birkat Kohanim, this priestly blessing, see the first blessing requesting physical safety and health. The second, asking for our material needs, food, clothing, shelter, to be satisfied. And the final blessing, the third part, seeking spiritual comfort, confidence. Without any one of these blessings, our lives are challenging. But with all three, we can be assured of true quality of life. After thousands of years, these three elements, safety, grace, and peace, remain central to our lives, a gift from God. May you each be blessed with all of these, with every one of these. This week of Parshat Naso, of this Torah portion that includes them for the first time, and every week. When we return in a moment on to Jewish, our guest, Denise Katz-Prober, the Director of Legal Initiatives at the Brandeis Center, tells us how they are working to counteract the anti-Semitism on campus that has exploded recently. Find out from her when we return in a moment right here on 2 Jewish.
We continue with our 2 Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, Columbia University settled a lawsuit brought against it by a Jewish student who alleged a hostile environment as a result of the pro-Palestinian terrorist encampment movement. The settlement is a major development in Jewish groups' efforts to hold universities accountable in light of the dramatic increase in campus anti-Semitism since October 7th. As part of the settlement, Columbia has promised to provide walking escorts and safe campus entrances at all hours of the day, as well as accommodations for students who are unable to complete exams owing to the campus disruption from the pro-terrorist encampments. "We are pleased we've been able to come to a resolution and remain committed to our number one priority, the safety of our campus, so that all our students can successfully pursue their education and meet their academic goals," a Columbia spokesperson said. The lawsuit was brought by an anonymous Jewish student in late April, alleging that the encampments had disrupted their education. The school faced significant disruption from the pro-Palestinian terrorism encampments, with clashes between students and police, hundreds of arrests, a move to hybrid classes online, extended campus closures, and the eventual cancellation of commencement. Jay Edelson, an attorney for the plaintiff, head of the law firm Edelson PC, said the settlement represents a return to basic shared principles of safety on campus for all Columbia students. Edelson's firm has taken an active role advocating for Jewish students amid the current campus climate. It announced in December it will no longer recruit Harvard Law students following controversial congressional testimony on anti-Semitism by then Harvard President Claudine Gay, who has since resigned. The Columbia settlement is the first significant legal resolution for Jewish students who have sought campus protections from anti-Semitism through the court system since October 7th. Several other Jewish-led lawsuits against elite universities are pending, as do more than 100 federal Title VI discrimination investigations at the U.S. Department of Education. That has become a popular mechanism for Jews seeking to hold universities and school districts accountable. Pro-Palestinian terrorist groups have also filed lawsuits and complaints alleging discrimination. These methods are increasingly overlapping, and in some cases, they cancel each other out. While the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights has yet to resolve any of the Title VI cases filed since the start of the Israel-Hamas war on October 7th, the department has dismissed at least five investigations after lawsuits were filed over the same incidents. The office promises to open every Title VI complaint it receives for investigation, regardless of the source or merit. But it also moves to close any active investigation that overlaps with a lawsuit, saying the same complaint should not be resolved through two different avenues. The dismissed investigations at Columbia, Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, MIT, and the Cooper Union were all at universities that were the sites of high-profile anti-Semitism actions. Columbia and other schools still have other active complaints filed on other grounds. The Columbia settlements suggest lawsuits might result in agreements more quickly than civil rights investigations. Last week, the Civil Rights Office announced a resolution in an anti-Semitism-related investigation, but one that was based on a complaint filed by a Jewish civil rights group last August. The Community School of Davidson, a charter school in North Carolina, agreed to review its anti-discrimination procedures and implement new staff training when students reportedly harassed a non-Jewish student who wore an Israeli Olympic jersey to school. That complaint, filed long before October 7th by the Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law, the law firm that frequently files civil rights challenges on behalf of Jewish or pro-Israel clients, and which our guest this morning represents, was notable for resting on perceived rather than actual Jewish ancestry. Remember, the kid wearing the jersey wasn't Jewish. In other news, a Vancouver Comics Festival apologized to a Jewish artist it banned over her past Israeli military service, and a Seattle museum announced it was recommitting to an exhibit on anti-Semitism that prompted a staff walkout. Two reversals of Arts World sanctions connected to the Israel-Hamas war. Both the Vancouver Comic Arts Festival and the Wing Luke Museum had faced significant backlash over the actions they took because of their pro-Palestinian terrorist activism. Vancouver Comic Arts Festival lost and continues to lose the trust of many we sought to serve, the Vancouver Festival said in its social media apology last week, days after announcing it was banning American-Israeli comics artist Miriam Lubicki following activist complaints over her past IDF service. The festival did not name Lubicki in either its initial statement banning her, which it quickly removed from social media following the backlash, or its lengthy new apology. But the ban referenced Lubicki's previous IDF service, which she has turned into a comic, while the apology referenced another specific work of hers, But I Live, a collaboration with Holocaust survivors. After criticism from both the artist and leaders of major Canadian Jewish institutions, the Vancouver Arts Festival said in its apology the vast majority of people involved in the ban have resigned from its board. The group said it was entering a new transition period as a result of the fallout, adding it has no full-time staff, it is entirely volunteer-run. Conflating the political with the practical safety of those attending our festival was the wrong stance to take, the apology noted. Vancouver Comics Arts Festival said it had issued the ban as a result of safety concerns after deeming that pro-Palestinian terrorist backlash to Lubicki's presence at its last two festivals created a volatile atmosphere. In other words, if you cause problems, you can get Jews kicked out. A synagogue in Vancouver was targeted for an arson attack last week, elevating alarm after shooting attacks on Jewish sites in Toronto and Montreal, also in Canada, of course. Authorities in Vancouver are investigating the arson as a hate crime. In Seattle, the Wing Luke Museum, an Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander heritage museum in Chinatown, will move forward with an exhibition on how the region's Asian, Jewish, and Black communities have all jointly responded to hate. The announcement came days after several museum staffers walked off the job, objecting to what they said were Zionist perspectives in the exhibit. The museum has temporarily shuttered following the walkout. We remain committed to the exhibit's core message of confronting hate, the museum said in a joint statement issued with the Washington State Jewish Historical Society, an exhibit partner, and the Black Heritage Society. We acknowledge the complexity of this deeply challenging work. We understand that the bigotry, bias, and racism affecting our communities goes well beyond us to touch many. Though recent events have caused significant harm, we are undeterred. The three groups also said they would make some unspecified changes to the content, offering additional framing on its genesis, the initial public reaction, and the history of our communities working together before the exhibit reopens on June 30th. Staff objected to some of the exhibit's descriptions of modern-day anti-Semitism, including the inclusion of campus pro-terrorist protests over October 7th. The staff demanded the museum make changes, including acknowledging a lack of Palestinian perspectives. The exhibit was in the works long before October 7th. Finally, the Indian nation of Maldives plans to bar Israeli passport holders from entering, protesting against Israel's war in Gaza. President Mohamed Mouizou announced the plan last week, saying on the recommendations of his cabinet, the government would seek to pass a law excluding Israelis from the country. He said he was launching Maldivians in Solidarity with Palestine, a rally and fundraising campaign to benefit Palestinians. The announcement marks one of the most sweeping efforts to penalize Israelis over Israel's military campaign against the brutal Palestinian terrorists of Hamas in Gaza that began on October 7th in the atrocities perpetrated by Hamas against Israelis. Other countries have taken action against Israel but have not imposed sanctions on individual Israelis. The Maldives, whose official state religion is Islam, does not have diplomatic relations with Israel. About 11,000 Israelis visited the Maldives last year, according to the tourism ministry there, a tiny fraction of the millions of visitors to the hundreds of guest houses and lavish resorts that generate the majority of the Maldives' tax revenue. Israel's foreign ministry is advising Israelis to avoid the Maldives. For Israeli citizens already in the country, it is recommended to consider leaving because if they find themselves in distress for any reason, it will be difficult for us to assist, the ministry said. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Denise Katz-Probers, Director of Legal Initiatives at the Brandeis Center. She previously was a trial attorney in the Office of the Attorney General of the District of Columbia, has been a criminal prosecutor, defended the District of Columbia in court, and now works for perhaps the most important organization, filing legal briefs and working against anti-Semitism on campus through the legal means. So since October 7th, not only has there been an intensive of anti-Israel activity, but there have been so many incidents of anti-Semitism. Tell us about how the encampment movement, as it is termed, affected all of that.
So, as I've been saying, I think it's important to remember that on too many college and university campuses, the problem of anti-Semitism has been endemic and systemic, and in particular anti-Zionist forms of anti-Semitism on campus have kind of become part of the culture. And so when the encampments sprung up, it's important to understand them as a symptom of a deeper problem. They certainly gave visibility to the underlying problem that we've been trying to address for years at the Brandeis Center, and they also are a manifestation of just the increased virulence of anti-Zionist forms of anti-Semitism. They became, on many campuses, centralized locations where students were able to engage in many times freely and openly, in anti-Semitic harassment and targeting of Jewish students. So it wasn't just that you had, on many campuses, vile anti-Semitic, anti-Israel rhetoric. You also had, targeting of Jewish students. You saw on campuses where Jewish students were trying to walk past areas of campus where the encampments were located, public areas of campus where Jewish students should have are freely entitled to access with any other students. And if they, especially if they were visibly Jewish, if they had a Star of David, or if they were, you know, quote unquote, known as being Jewish or Zionist, they were harassed, they were accosted, they were confronted, they were spat on, or they were not allowed to get through certain areas on campus where the campus was located if you're trying to get to class or to a building where they have the right to access. So once again, I think it's important to remember that there have been various violations of laws that people who are involved with these encampments have committed. And one of the big problems that we see is that university administrators are not doing enough to address clear violations of both university policy by the encampment, as well as violations of federal law involving harassment, discrimination due to students by those involved with the encampment.
So how does the Brandeis Center address these issues, which seem so widespread? They're showing up on so many campuses. My alma mater, UCLA, Michigan, Texas, Vanderbilt, and of course all of the Ivy League problems we've seen. That's a lot of different places to address.
That's true. And, you know, one of our approaches is to take things on a case-by-case basis. We are hearing from students and increasingly faculty on so many campuses. And where there is a basis to where we believe that a violation of federal law has occurred, specifically Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which is the law that protects Jewish students from harassment and discrimination on campuses, we will file federal anti-discrimination complaints with the Office for Civil Rights, the Department of Education. Where appropriate, we have and will continue to file lawsuits in court. There are a number of tools at our disposal that we can use in order to start forcing universities to do what they are not doing, which is take steps that they're legally obligated to take Jewish students from harassment and discrimination that is happening on campus.
I guess I'm going to ask a question that might seem sort of conspiratorial, but I've always wondered, the development of all of these pro-Palestinian groups on so many campuses seems to me that it cannot simply be spontaneous, and there must be some funding and direction that came from somewhere on this, whether they've been funded by Arab oil money, whether it's Qatar or Iran or somebody. Is that just a conspiracy theory, or is there some evidence for that?
Well, that's not an area that the Brandeis Center necessarily focuses on. I, too, have read concerning reports about outside influence in terms of supporting the encampment. There have been concerns for years about foreign donations and funding for Middle East studies programs, for instance, that are fomenting a lot of anti-Israel and anti-American and anti-Semitic ideas and narratives. So I think that there are multiple angles that those who are concerned about the future of our universities can take to approach this problem. The Brandeis Center, you know, is narrowly focused on using legal tools to protect students, as well as on educating the public about what's going on campus, about different forms of anti-Semitism, and empowering both students and members of the community and families to understand what they can do to push back and advocate for themselves.
Which campuses have been the most responsive to the Brandeis Center's work in your experience?
Well, I think that there have been campuses over the years that, you know, are willing to work with the Brandeis Center. It depends on the nature of the problem. It depends on, you know, I think sometimes who the university leadership are. Unfortunately, what we found is that sometimes there does need to be some sort of legal pressure, even if it's publicity about a legal letter that we give to the university or that we send the university. Sometimes that's what it takes for the university to turn around and actually do something. So a good example of that is, for instance, at the University of Vermont, we did end up having to file a Title VI complaint with the Department of Education, and that case was resolved through a settlement with the Department of Education. But what we heard in the immediate aftermath of that resolution was that the university was actually doing things a little bit better that Jewish students felt more, that the university was more responsive when they were filing, bias complaints because of the experience of anti-Semitism on campus. So, unfortunately, fortunately, we know what the appropriate tool is. A lot of times, I think, in the majority of cases, it does take some sort of pressure on the university to get them to really do the right thing. But we have found that those pressure points might be effective.
The means of exerting such pressure are to file lawsuits primarily, right? What's the first step that the Brandeis Center takes when it's informed about a problem at a university?
The Brandeis Center won't jump to file a lawsuit or to file a Title VI complaint. We want to understand what's going on. We want to talk to, of course, the students who's coming to us to understand what's going on in terms of that particular incident, as well as, the climate more generally on campus. And many times we do try and reach out to the university and figure out how we can work with the university to help. We are always open to taking that approach and imparting our expertise and guidance to assist universities in making their environments more tolerable for students. But I think sometimes it gets to a point where the universities are not responsive or the problem is so entrenched that it becomes necessary to exert legal pressure. And that's when we may, if the facts and the law support it, that's when we may turn to using tools like administrative complaints with filed with OCR, the Office of Civil Rights, or lawsuits filed in court.
When a lawsuit is filed, obviously the university then contests it to some degree. Do negotiations continue through that process?
It can, and I think that, as I mentioned, sometimes the pressure of a lawsuit or the negative publicity does make the university pay attention or be more willing to engage in some sort of talks, or it makes the university more conducive to, taking action to make things better. It's unfortunate that that's the reality, but we have seen that happen.
The federal government seems to have been filing more, whether they're lawsuits, I don't know the exact correct term legally, you certainly do. It's Title IX complaints, Title VI, I'm a little confused on that. Can you clarify what the government seems to have been doing more actively over the last few months?
So a minute ago, we have talked about lawsuits that are filed, complaints that are filed in court, handled through our court system. There is also, the Department of Education has an office called the Office of Civil Rights, and they are tasked with enforcing the civil rights laws that protect Jewish students, among other civil rights laws, but some of which are the Civil Rights Law Title VI of the Civil Rights Act that protect students from harassment and discrimination in federally funded programs. So that's most public universities,
all public universities, yeah.
And so when I talk about administrative or Title VI complaints that are filed with the Office of Civil Rights, talking about administrative process handled through the Education Department, OCR, Office of Civil Rights. So in the news, there has been a lot of coverage of sort of an uptick in the filing, in particular, of these administrative complaints with OCR. Many of them, we at the Brandeis Center have filed many. We were filing them well before October 7th. That has historically been one of the primary avenues through which we have tried to exert legal pressure on universities. And we continue to do so after October 7th. And so that is a different system altogether than the court system, which is, as mentioned, we can file lawsuits instead of court, on state court as well, at the university.
I want to thank Denise Katz-Prober for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the work of the Brandeis Center?
They can go to www.brandeiscenter.com.
Thank you so much, and keep up the good fight. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Dr. Sarah Glass, therapist and author of the new book, Kissing Girls on Shabbat. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading in Kiddush, in person with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and available on our Facebook page. The Torah study is on Zoom. Our playout this morning comes from the holiday of Shavuot this Tuesday night and Wednesday. It's quite a silly song called Up All Night, about studying all night on Shavuos. My friends, may you have a Chag Shavuot Sameach, a happy holiday of Shavuot, some delicious cheesecake, I hope, a Shavuot Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week, we pray profoundly, of justice and peace.
The sixth of Sivan, it's the day that we receive on.
Anything you want to learn, it's all right.
Put some water in the urn.
Stay up all night.
Put on your fedora. Time for Kabbalah Satorah.
Anything you want to wear, it's all right.
Just keep those thumbs in the air.
Stay up all night.
Chomesh Chazara,
Mishnah Chazara,
Gemara Chazara,
yeah!
Eat a melon or a mango when you do the Torah tango.
Priya Adama or Eight, that's right.
Got to make it tonight.
Stay up all night.
Say some prakim of Tehillim. Keep your coffee cup from spilling.
If you're starting to sway, it's all right.
Try our cheesecake buffet.
Stay up all night.
Navi Chazara,
Musar Chazara,
Halacha Chazara,
yeah!
So wake up your chavrusas. This is no time for excuses.
Anything to help you focus, it's alright.
Cause there's really no machlokis.
Stay up all night.
Hold on to your stander. We can't possibly surrender.
Cause you know it is Shavuos, that's right.
And the only thing to do is
stay up all night.
Cause you know it is Shavuos, that's right.
And the only thing to do is
stay up all night.
Gonna stay up all.
Gonna stay up all.
We're gonna stay up all night.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.